Let's say you're lost in a park. Sure, you can give in to the dark, or you can trip a little like fantastic with me. When you're alone in your room, your choice is just embrace the gloom, or you can trip a little like fantastic with me.
For if hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers off season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and do I invest my tuppence? No, I feed the birds.
My name is Rena Robinson, and tuppence, that's for paper and string.
And I'm Neil Miller, and as far as I know, I put my tuppence under my mattress, I think. I think it's some sort of money thing.
Oh, Neil.
Right?
Two pence, yes.
Yeah. But also, doesn't it just mean like an insignificant amount of money or something?
Like, I don't
give an allowance?
I don't give tuppence for your opinion.
My interpretation of it, based on limited knowledge of bibliophile culture and having seen Mary Poppins twice, is that it's like an allowance.
It's just a unit of money. It's like two cents.
It's two pence.
Two pence.
Tuppence. Anyway, this is the Poppins hype episode. It's finally here. We've waited all year for a big Disney release in December. Guess what it is? It's Mary Poppins Returns.
Chim-chim-chiroo, motherfuckers!
We're going to dedicate a whole episode to Poppins because hashtag Poppins hype. It deserves it. We've been building all year to this point. So we're going to spend all episode talking about it. There's going to be some spoilers, I guess, but it's Mary Poppins, so the only real spoiler is letting it, stream into your eyes the way it's meant to be seen in theaters this Wednesday. Mary Poppins Returns. But first, I have to tell you, friends, about Con of Thrones. Next year, which is rapidly approaching, 2019, July 12th through 14th in Nashville, Con of Thrones, the Game of Thrones convention, will be happening. Make sure to get your tickets now if you haven't, including hotel reservations, unless you live in Nashville, in which case, lucky you. There's a really good podcast about like music history called like Rhinestones and Cocaine. Maybe you could check it out. Anyway, if you're a Maester of Small Council Patreon donor here at patreon.com/stormofspoilers, thank you very much for making the show possible. You'll be getting a bonus segment this week. We'll be talking about Penny Marshall, who sadly passed away this week, but had a very illustrious career, including, you know, some of our favorite films like Big, A League of Their Own. We're going to talk about it more in this week's bonus segment. All right, that's all the business I have for you at the top of the show. Joanna, do we have any reviews?
I'm assuming we do, but let's just stall for a second while I figure that out. I did want to say that we finally got our like official invitation to Con of Thrones. So like, though we were pretty sure before that we were going to Con of Thrones, we are definitely going. So we will be there, doing our usual thing at Con of Thrones. But also, I will just tell you guys, I can't say who, but I've heard rumors of some really cool guests that they're going to be having at Con of Thrones this year. So, just a few
more. Is that about me?
It's Neil Miller, everybody.
Hey.
All right. So, let's see. I am just trying to figure out if I read these reviews before.
Before in the future? Time's all wibbly wobbly in the Mary Poppins episode.
It's true. I like this one from Penguin Tom, 5 stars, a cross promotional game of Dave's. I've been inspired this week to finally leave reviews for my two favorite podcasts, both of which are produced by Dave Gonzalez. Episodes of A Storm of Spoilers and Finding the War Room usually show up on my podcatcher at the same time every week. So I like to play a game trying to figure out which episode actually was recorded first based on Dave's references to the same material in both podcasts.
Yes.
That was like basically a mwahaha. This week, Dave offered a plethora of Into the Spider-Verse related CGI jargon in both episodes about digital puppets, comic book color bleeding, and animation styles. 3D may be a step too far. I didn't understand any of it, but this is far and away my favorite episode of A Game of Dave's. 5 stars. Now Dave can try to figure out which of these reviews I wrote first, because apparently he wrote one for Fitware. Maybe David Ehrlich read it. Maybe he didn't. P.S. Apologies to join in advance, but it's my birthday, so... Pew, pew, pew. All right. And then this one features my other Storm Bro. Caller listener from Ohio, 5 stars. Great listen, plus Neil is from Cleveland. This podcast has gotten stronger over the years, even as it deals with less with its original source material. I prefer the off-season stuff more than the Game of Thrones stuff at this point, and even listen when I don't know much or care much about the topics they've chosen. Special shout out to the holiday episode this year, which is fun. Plus, Neil basically described my childhood in West Cleveland suburbs. Midnight masses, driving around looking at holiday lights to get out of the family gatherings, etc. I knew without a doubt that he is going to pick as his favorite holiday beverage, GLBC's Christmas Ale, which doesn't taste like a Christmas tree as much as it tastes like everything you love about the holidays in beer form. Christmas Ale is one thing Clevelanders are proud of beyond all else, probably even more than LeBron, and Neil should have talked about his awesomeness for about 5 minutes longer than he did. Keep up the great work. All right. So,
yeah, I mean, it sounds like facts to me.
Yeah. Facts and facts upon facts.
Just lots of facts.
I don't know if you, I also like to play the Game of Dave's. And whenever I see that Fitware Fighting the War Room has talked about the same thing we've talked about, I like to hear if Dave has said the exact same thing. Usually it's a little different. But it's always it's always fun to hear Dave on multiple topics. And I wouldn't know anything about talking about the same show on multiple podcasts over the course of a week.
No, certainly not.
I would just like to say that at the moment, this is the exclusive home
of Neil Miller Takes. Subscribe for 100% Neil Miller Takes.
And we should also say, you know, that if you're still looking for holiday items, the chaosislit.com still goes to our merch page where you can pick up t-shirts and Don't Fall Down pins and all.
Can
of
I
that.
Tell a small story about this?
Please do.
I was out drinking with some friends, and we were at a tequila bar, and the guy came up to bus our table and is like, "Is that a Don't Fall Down pin?" And I'm like, "Yes." And my friend Julian looked at me like, "Here comes a storm of spoilers, guy." But apparently it's also a thing in like a Jamaican reggae festival. They have like these Don't Fall Down signs. And so I ended up getting in a conversation with this gentleman about the importance of not falling down. So whether or not you have friends that listen to the podcast, apparently this pin, it crosses cultures and country lines. Don't fall
it's
down.
It's really breaking down barriers is what that pin's doing.
Yeah.
Can I also tell a story?
Please do.
So I've obviously been testing fate. You'll know more about this next week. with Don't Fall Down, and I have not, as of our recording, fallen down. But I've tested fate in a number of ways, but the one way I've apparently decided not to is I have not ordered a pin yet. So I am not ordering a pin until the clock strikes midnight on January 1st.
I'm ordering one for the new year. That's what I'm doing, and it's going to protect me.
Yeah, I'm not gonna order it until the year's over, because I feel like that might actually be the line where karma comes up and just like slaps me.
Yeah, it's like, now that you got the merch, eat the floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm at.
Well, good. You could get your pins at chaosislit.com, and whether it wards off falling down, it certainly has for me, and gets you into interesting conversations with guys bussing your table at the tequila bar, saying that all out loud. Might not be for all people, but that doesn't do that to all guys at tequila bars. So just this, that one particular one. Neil, save me.
Oh, Dave. Well, from the tequila bar, we shall go out into the wilderness where we are going storm chasing. This is where we, of course, talk about a movie, show, book, story, podcasts.
Is Joanna dead? Joanna, are you dead?
Oh, I'm sorry. I muted my mic because traffic was so loud outside, and I was pewing, and you guys could hear me.
Oh, no.
Pew, pew, pew. All right, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. Now that we're ready.
Yeah.
Now that we've officially started storm chasing, I'll go first, as I normally do, I guess. I would like to give you guys an update from my political super PAC, which is called Letterkenny for America. This is the promotion of Letterkenny inside the United States. I am vice chairman. Some good news. Hulu has announced that they're going to put out seasons 3 and 4. Now, they're as of Christmas Day, there will be 6 seasons of Letterkenny that exist. And not all of them are available here in the United States. They are dropping season 6 on Canada's Crave TV network all at once on Christmas Day. So if you live in Canada and you subscribe to Crave, very jealous. But for the rest of us, seasons 3 and 4 are going to be on Hulu on December 27th, which is awesome. And Hulu also announced that they are going to get all 6 seasons on there probably pretty soon. And we've already gotten the first 4 within, you know, a couple months, so shouldn't be too long. We'll have American access to what is really the comedy of our time. So,
well, one of many good Canadian comedies of late.
Yeah, that's true.
But definitely in the top tier.
So, yeah, so that is an official update from Letterkenny for America. Joanna, speaking of America, I believe you've been traveling, but you've also been tweeting about a movie this week. Right? You were tweeting about this movie?
Yeah.
Okay, tell us all about
it. Well, it is the
20th. You've got 20th. Mail.
20th feels right. 25th would 15th. Not surprise me.
I'm not that close to 21.
All right, it is the 20th anniversary of the Nora Ephron classic rom-com You've Got Mail, starring Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks and Dave Chappelle and Steve Zahn and a bunch of other people. And this is a film that I love, and it is a film that has been, or a story that has been retold and remade a bunch of different times. I believe it started as like a Hungarian play in the 1930s. There's a 1930s, or maybe even earlier, there's a 1930s film with Jimmy Stewart called The Shop Around the Corner. There is a 50s film with Judy Garland and Buster Keaton, and called In the Good Old Summertime. There's a Broadway musical called She Loves Me. And then there is You've Got Mail, and all of it is the same story, with slightly different permutations. And, I grew up with like The Shop Around the Corner and In the Good Old Summertime. And when I was, you know, a teenager, I think, God, 20 years ago, You've Got Mail came out. And yes, I am fine with you, anyone making fun of it for being like kind of dated, because it's like AOL dial up. You know, in every version, permutation of the story, it's about pen pals who, like, fall in love, to each other, with each other via, like, anonymous letters, but meet each other under some circumstances in real life and don't like each other. And so it's like, I hate you, but I love you sort of scenario. And in You've Got Mail, which takes its title from the AOL, like, alert, You've Got Mail. You mm-hmm. know.
Look it up. Google it, guys. Yeah. It's a thing. What she's referencing. It existed.
So that just makes it, like, so like, it could, if it had been, like an anonymous, like, if it just hadn't been that AOL thing that just, like, time stamps it so exactly. But anyway, like, it doesn't matter, because the promises from the leads are charming. This is a story, also happens to be a story about bookshops. Earlier versions were about, like, perfumeries and music shops and stuff like that. But this is about bookshops, which I worked in bookshops for years and years and years. So this is, like, dear to my heart as well. It's about the struggle of the independent bookstore in the crushing face of, like, the monolith chain store. Not something I care about a lot. It's a great love letter to New York film. It's just filled with great, great performances. Greg Kinnear is great in this. Parker Posey is great in this. I just love this film. And I understand how it has become problematized, the way that, like, Baby It's Cold Outside has become problematized. But, like, I don't think that's a productive use of our fighting the system time. And I think this is just a very like pleasant, lovely movie with not a terrible message. Yes, I would prefer if he didn't gaslit her. No, I don't believe we can make this movie again with these genders. Maybe if you swap them, but like that didn't work with Overboard. So I just think some dynamics are probably less like best left in the past. So anyway.
Also, it's got Tom Hanks.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if it were anyone other than Tom Hanks doing some of the stuff that he does in that movie, then like, you know, we would throw it out the window. But
Tom Hanks is like the Idris Elba of his generation.
Oh, Idris had a good quote yesterday, man.
Idris,
you've never seen Godfather? Go to the mattresses. Yeah.
It's your turn.
Oh, yes. So as you guys might remember, I chose the tomato god in last season of Fortnite, and it was great. Fortnite is a seasonal game, which means there are updates. There are updates every week, but there are gigantic, larger updates every 10 weeks. They call seasons. They involve like changes to the maps, changes to different dynamics of the game. This season, season 7, is like winter themed. We're currently on the cusp of 14 days of Fortnite, which will have all sorts of weird things. But the most notable thing about season 7 of Fortnite is every update that they've put in thus far has added something that has basically broken the game. Which is really interesting because it's gone alongside some of their tournaments. So they introduced an Infinity Blade, which is something from another game Epic produced. It was Infinity Blade. It was on like iPhones and whatnot. It used the Unreal Engine on mobile. It was a big thing back in the day. They introduced that weapon into the game as like a weapon that could not instantly kill people, but do tons of damage really quickly. And it would give you a whole bunch of extra shields and a whole bunch of extra health, and you regenerate health the more times you killed people. They introduced it into the game without telling anybody the same morning they were having a qualifying round for one of their professional tournaments. So there was this huge uproar of like this, mechanic of this sword that could break through buildings, which is like the core mechanic of Fortnite. In the middle of this pro tournament, they had to take the sword out. They had to, they added planes into the game, and they had to reduce the amount of damage planes did because it was too easy just to kill people. And now this week they were supposed to add a snowboard, but apparently there's some sort of horrible bug with that. So that patch has been pushed a week. It has been a rough season of Fortnite. But the weird thing is all these like game breaking mechanics means it also is easier for like non-professional players to like be competitive. So once again, Fortnite is like weirdly accessible for this weird period of time. So you'll see like 6 year olds dominating across like other older people. Anyway, that's what's up with Fortnite. It's been interesting. It's kind of broken.
They're also getting sued by Carlton from Fresh Prince.
And
the Backpack
million.
Kid.
And the Backpack Kid.
They're getting sued by a lot of people for using their emotes. It's interesting because I like kind of want those emotes now to see if like they get stripped from the game, and if they get stripped from the game, if I get some sort of reward for like having an emote taken away from me. Anyway,
how can
more
I
on that
to my advantage?
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. Well, whatever. I think there were a whole bunch of kids that played the release of the Galaxy Note 7 or 9 or whatever to their advantage and had these crazy skins. I need to start scamming people in real life for Fortnite is what I'm learning.
Oh my god. I mean, I feel like that's perfect place for this segment to end.
Yes, good. More admissions of crimes. Like the president. And we're back to talk about Mary Poppins. It's the Poppins hype segment. This is where we talk about the things we liked about Mary Poppins Returns, of which I think there are many. But first, I want to ask you guys a question about this movie. Is it a sequel? Is it a remake? Because I don't want to give away... Well, I mean, I guess I have to just by give away some things inherently by talking about the plot. It follows a lot of the same beats of the first movie in the sense that they're basically going to and from the same locations in the same order, which was really, I think, something I didn't notice until the Mary Poppins Returns ended. And there's a lot of spiritual echoes, I think, is what we would call them in the modern franchiseology or whatever, of the first Mary Poppins. But then it's not exactly Mary Poppins. It's like if you took the outline of the first movie and added new scenes into the same locations. Have we seen a movie that's anything like that before?
The Force Awakens?
Mm-hmm.
Well, but I mean, that's like not exactly the same locations. It's just very, very similar.
Well, yeah.
Well, these aren't exactly the same locations. It's like the Royal Dalton Bowl versus inside a chalk painting, or, you know.
Well, they go inside a piece of 2D art. They go to the exact same bank. They have the exact same house. The park is the exact same park.
I mean, they go inside the Millennium Falcon. Like, I don't really want to. The thing is, like, I agree with you. When I walked out of it, the first thing I said to my friend who's a Disney rep who was there was like, you're going to get the same pushback you got on Force Awakens, which is that this is a beat-for-beat remake of, you know, a beloved film. And something he said to me was like, aha, yes, but this time we get to say, take it up with P.L. Travers, because it's all in her book. So then I went and I read all of the Mary Poppins books by P.L. Travers. And indeed, P.L. Travers just repeats herself over and over again. Ah, someone is selling something else different that sends you flying up in the air. Ah, blah, blah. So like the topsy-turvy stuff, that's in the book, as is the Uncle Albert stuff in the first one. Or the Royal Dalton Bowl, that's in the book, as is the chalk painting from the first one. You know, so it's like P.L. Travers did this, where she just like sent the Banks children on like a series of similar adventures, book by book by book.
And interesting.
So, if you want, like, I'm not saying I disagree with your take, but I think Disney is somewhat protected more than they were with The Force Awakens in saying, yes, but that's the nature of the Mary Poppins stories. And that's true of a lot of children's, series. You know, if you read every book in the series, you're like, this is very similar to an adventure you had two books ago, children. You know, so, I'm saying of all my gripes with Mary Poppins, and that's so funny because we're in the Mary Poppins hype section, but of all my gripes, that's not one that's sticking with me, because I do agree that the source material and like the fact that they pulled so much from the source material, which they did, including like song lyrics and stuff like that, really protects it in my view as an adaptation.
Yeah, I don't think I was saying it as like a negative thing. I'm just not sure exactly what to call it. I mean, I think the Force, like it's just a sequel based to like.
Well, it's a sequel, but it isn't, because I would call it almost like a sequel, like Mad Max Fury Road is a sequel in that like it's the same world,
or a sequel like the James Bond movies are sequels of each other. It's like it's another Mary Poppins adventure.
Yeah, yeah. It's like another collection of anthology
and
stories.
Some of the characters are the same characters, right? From this movie to the last. Like, so the dad in this movie is the kid from the last movie. That's not a spoiler, right?
That right. And then the I think that the housekeeper is supposed to be the same person.
Sure. So like,
and then the Admiral Boom's the same person.
So that to me says sequel, just like we would call The Force Awakens a sequel. You know, it's the start of a new trilogy, which I'm sure Mary Poppins is also the start of a new trilogy. But it's a legacy sequel, which I think is a Matt Singer coined term, where it's like it's a sequel, but it's like way later. Although, as far as I could tell, the timeline of this new movie is like, obviously, it's only been like 20 years or whatever.
So. Yeah, I think so. I don't know exactly how much it is, but it does sort of take place. What is it they say during the great?
I don't know. Whatever it is, it's the Great Leary Uprising.
Yeah, there's definitely a Great Leary Uprising. There's so many Learys, lamppost workers, but it's something about like the great. It's some sort of suppression, depression. I forget what the opening title is already, but they do sort of pin it. In a vague historical time for England.
You can just see how much older it just takes place, you know, in the time that young Michael Banks would have, you know, to grow up to be Ben Whishaw with three small children of his own, you know?
Yes. Which brings us to our next prompt. Who is really good in this? Someone has written in Ben Whishaw, duh.
That's me.
Who? Oh. Explain yourself.
Ben Whishaw is fucking great in this. I mean, Emily Blunt's great in this, honestly, I think so. But like, Ben Whishaw is, I think, just, I am a huge fan of Ben Whishaw, so like, obviously, like, I'm biased, but he, I think, really elevates the material. So, that's my answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's Emily Blunt, for sure. She's really good, and there are scenes where, and this is something we'll talk about more extensively later. There are scenes where she's really singing against Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's like legit good at like rapping and that sort of like, you know, that rhythm, and she's in it and it's good. I think she's great. And she's great as Mary Poppins and magical. See, I wish there was more of her in this movie.
And that's the, there's a prompt later, I guess, that we'll talk about, in Poppins Gripes, but like, you know, if you're talking about like a James Bond or, a Mad Max, he's not Mad Max, right? He has a different last name, Max, whatever.
Max Rockatansky.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Max Rockatansky. Like, Mel Gibson's Max and Tom Hardy's Max are, like, not the same Max. You know what I mean? And Daniel Craig's Bond and Sean Connery's Bond are not the same Bond. And mm-hmm. so I like Emily Blunt's take on Mary Poppins because I actually think it's closer to the book. You know, someone on Twitter, I remember when the first trailer came out, you know, and she's very imperious, obviously, in this film. And what's funny is, like, if you read the books, and you know, I'm just going to be the obnoxious book reader person throughout this whole podcast, but, like, if you read the books...
I think that's pretty much what people show up for anyway.
So brand strong. If you read the books, Mary Poppins is, like, actually an asshole. and so, like, you know, Julie Andrews put a very, like, you know, spoonful of sugar spin on her. Like, she's got her nose in the air, you know, and she's very, like, spit spot, but she's so much nicer than Mary Poppins in the books. And then Emily Blunt is a little bit closer to the book version, where she's just like kind of harsh sometimes and very remote. And like, it's funny because like Disney's never going to give us the Mary Poppins of the books. And that's, I think, a lot of people who are fans of the books, or, you know, especially P.L. Travers, who hated the original Mary Poppins film, like, are disappointed by. But like,
Try that with that Saving Mr. Banks movie.
Well, Saving Mr. Banks is about how P.L. Travers hated Mary Poppins.
I don't remember that movie very well at all.
Oh, Emma Thompson played P.L. Travers as someone who, as the author.
And Tom Hanks coming in for a second mention in this podcast.
And we'll talk about him later when we talk about Penny Marshall. And Rachel Griffith, like, Mary Poppins is based on P.L. Travers' aunt, who came after her, like, mom died, and I think, and her dad was a terrible alcoholic, as played by Colin Farrell in that movie. And her aunt came to visit with, like, a carpet bag and an umbrella, played by Rachel Griffiths in, that Save Mr. Banks, and is, like, was a very harsh figure, but who nonetheless, like, sort of, got everything together in their lives. I mean, probably not exactly, but like came to fix things. And that's who P.L. Travers based Mary Poppins on, was like her very harsh aunt. And so like the movie Saving Mr. Banks is like, bounces back and forth between Walt Disney's attempt to make this movie. Cause I think he tried for like his daughter loved the Mary Poppins books and really wanted it to be made into a film. He wanted to be made into a film, and P.L. Travers is like, hell no, you don't get the rights to my films. And that, I think, took decades. And then finally, like, she signed on and they tried to like work with her, and she was just like very hard to work with, because she wanted a movie that was close to her books, and they're like, cool, but we're Disney, we're not gonna do that. And so eventually,
cool, but we have Julie Andrews.
Yeah, eventually,
exactly,
she's pretty great.
Eventually they like edged her out of the project, which is hard to think about, an author being sort of edged out of her own project. But at the same time, like, I consider the original Mary Poppins to be a masterpiece. But like, anyway, that's a long way around to say that I think that Emily Blunt, like, any differences you're seeing in the way that Emily Blunt plays it versus the way Julie Andrews plays it is Emily Blunt playing it closer to the page, actually, which is kind of interesting. So I think.
Anyway. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
She's great.
Maya, who's really good in this, is a spoiler, but we're going to go for it because it's in headlines all over.
He's in the trailer.
He's in the trailer. Yeah. It's Dick Van Dyke.
He was great in it.
Because, like, damn.
Does Dick Van Dyke do all his own dancing in this movie?
He does, yes. Actually. Yeah.
Okay. That's a really impressive thing.
I know. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, he's pretty old.
When the doors opened and Dick Van Dyke stepped out looking like he did in the first movie, but naturally this time, I was like, oh, I get it now. Like, I'd read that he was going to play that character, but it was a pleasure to see him do it and to have, like, a singing and dance number, which I was you know, expecting, but not expecting him to actually be that spry. Good old 94-year-old Dick Van Dyke. Sweet. All right. Best sequence. This is the tough one. What was your... Or let's not do best. Best is weird. Let's do your favorite. Your favorite sequence from Mary Poppins Returns, Neil Miller.
Well, I think it's the sad song that Mary Poppins sing. Well, sort of. I guess it's sad.
The Where Do Lost Things Go?
Yeah, the Lost Things song where Mary Poppins is singing to the kids as they're sort of getting ready to sleep. Just brought the house down. Not a dry eye in the place. And that was really, you know, the bathtub sequence, I think, is first, right? If I'm remembering the movie correctly, even though I've seen it twice in the last week. So the bathtub sequence is great and it's very fun. But this was like the first moment where I was like, ah, yes, there's the Mary Poppins sort of emotional magic. And I think that sequence works really well.
Joanna.
Yeah, I have to say, like, the bathtub sequence is really cool. I watched it in theaters, then I watched it at home. And, like, when I watched it in theaters and that like, first dolphin sort of, like, pops up out of the bathtub, and I'm like, oh, like.
And she's like, not yet. It's the line delivery on that's so great, too.
It's really good. And then, like, I was watching it at home, and my roommate Diana was, like, half watching, half working. And that dolphin popped up. She's like, okay, that was good. I was like, it is. It's good. No, I think it's the music hall inside the Royal Dalton Bowl. The Royal Dalton Music Hall
The trip to the Royal Dalton Music Hall or the performance within?
The performance within. Okay. I think I liked that. Dave will explain to me why I'm a bad person for liking it, but I quite liked it. And but I mean, honestly, once again, for me, Ben Whishaw really makes this movie. Ben Whishaw has grown up Michael Banks. And so, like, his first song in the, I know you said sequence and we're saying songs, but, like, his first song in the attic of 17 Cherry Tree Lane, which is so, like, you know, Neil mentioned this, that, like, emotional authenticity, and that, like, darkness that I think, you get with, like, Feed the Birds in the original. Here's some, like, real genuine sorrow, and Ben Whishaw just, like, really goes for it. And that, to me, once again, gives, this film the heft that it wouldn't have if it were just, like, lamplighters high kicking and, you know, balloons and stuff like that. So, yeah. I cheated and gave some answers, but if I had to just pick one thing to watch over and over again on the YouTubes, it would probably be Ben Whishaw in the attic with the sadness. Dave,
worst game of Clue ever.
Best game. What's
yours? The reason I put sequence down here is because mine is actually the turning back time sequence from, like, we're gonna turn back time and then they have to climb up Big Ben and turn back time. Which, you know,
great where they're like, but I have so many questions.
Well, I mean, the physics of Mary, but if that point, if you're not just giving over to the physics of Mary Poppins, then, that's the way it's going to be for you. I guess you hate joy, but I really like the idea, just as I was watching it, that's when my imagination took off. When they're like, the kids are like, we're going to turn back time. And Mary Poppins is like, I suppose we could arrange it. I'm like, what the shit's going to happen now? And then it was just like turning back the clock. And then it like clicked in my mind that Admiral Boom had been firing 5 minutes early. I'm like, of course it was always going to be this. But that moment,
it was like a heist.
It was like a heist.
Like Danny Ocean would do that.
Well, and then I had all the lamplighters coming in on their bikes, and then they're all working together. And then I just like that idea that it made everything purposeful and like a plot moment. It really worked for me because at that point in the movie, you are sort of getting used to like each sequence sort of bleeding into the other just because it has to. And so that was when the movie sort of like clicked together for me. And I'm like, we're in the end game now. And it was nice.
Yeah, but it's a little heist ex machina, though, don't you think?
I don't know.
I think so. I don't know. It's planted pretty firmly that
she lets all those dudes climb up Big Ben, and then she's like, hold on, never mind, I'll get it.
Well, apparently they've done it before, according to her spry remark. That's the life of being a Poppins, Neil.
We'll come back to this over reliance on Learys later.
Yeah. If we didn't live in a world where the Learys wouldn't, you know, take up the causes of small children at the drop of Mary Poppins' hat.
And I will say this.
World would I'm Learys. In? I'm Leery of all Learys. Yes.
My favorite joke in the movie, though, is the Admiral Boom joke. Because I it took me a while to catch that was what was happening when he kept saying that, you know, Big Ben's, you know, 5 minutes off.
Mm-hmm.
I always appreciate a movie going there. Like, setting up a joke in, like, minute three, like a little insignificant-ish joke, and then paying it off big at the end. Always a fan of that. So,
can I just say,
that was my favorite one.
Since we're talking spoilers, right? And you're in here, yeah, and you don't mind getting spoiled by Mary Poppins. We all, like, I can't tell if, like, I just happened to catch it or anyone would catch it that, like, the thing that they were looking for was on the back of that sketch that Georgie put on the kite, like, at the very beginning.
Right? Oh, yeah. I didn't notice that. In fact, Until you just said that, I thought that it wasn't the sketch, that it was the other patches.
No.
Because remember, it was, like, sort of patched up when he gave it to him. See, I'm way too deep.
Well, no, it was like, it's one of those like Mary Poppins things where she's like, Georgie, take this trash out, and hands him the thing with the sketch right at the top. So Mary Poppins knows that what they're looking for is on that sketch right at the top of the bin. And she gives it to Georgie, and she knows that Georgie's going to take it outside and grab that sketch and like hold on to it. So the thing that being there. And then also the other thing is when they're inside the Royal Dalton Bowl and the wolf first pops up and he's like, and he starts speaking and I'm like, oh, this is going to be a voice, you know, because I'd already like identified Chris O'Dowd or whatever. But like the wolf starts talking and I'm like, okay, this is going to be a voice I should know. And then he did the thing with the pocket watch. And I was like, oh, it's Colin Firth. Oh, it's also Colin Firth. Oh, this is going to be so fun. So these are just thoughts that I had while watching Mary Poppins. Off prompt. Sorry. Okay.
Well, I mean, it wasn't really off prompt because our next prompt is what lived up to the Poppins hype. Those sound like moments that lived up to the Poppins hype.
Ben Whishaw, his mustache, and Emily Blunt. And those kids are really good. Those are good kids.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Emily Blunt, the kids, and the 2D animation.
No, you can't. Don't say that in front of Dave. Shh.
I'm glad you were charmed, Neil. One can't account for taste.
And you know what? Listen, I can't let this go. We need to say this in this segment because it's true. We cannot just move past a Game of Thrones alumni playing a horse.
Yes.
Mark Addy.
Yes.
King Robert Baratheon. Great job as Chris O'Dowd's horse. Chris O'Dowd playing the dog.
Playing an
Irish dog with
Irish setter, of course.
Anyway, we'll talk about the animation later.
Actually, I think Chris O'Dowd is one of, like, I think almost everyone knew what movie they were in, but, like, sometimes people, like, really know what the movie they're in, and Chris O'Dowd, like, definitely just thinking of him in the sound booth.
He's always extremely aware.
Just thinking of him in the sound booth going, oh, Mary Poppins, you know? Just, like, fills me with joy. Yeah.
All right. If you could participate in one Poppins vignette from this movie, Returns
or,
vignette.
Or the old one.
Or the old one. Oh, that's why Flying Kites is on here. Okay, good. Or the old one. So you have all Poppins vignettes in which to participate in. So, like, I don't know, reverse cleaning your room if you want. Which one would you participate in? Joanna, you go first this time.
Super extra bath time with dolphins. I love baths. You gonna put dolphins in there too? Great, great. Good times.
Neil?
This is kind of a tough one. I think it's just straight up balloons. Because yeah, I want to meet Angela Lansbury. I want to have an awesome oversized balloon, and flying sounds fun. So there's that.
Yeah. See, I don't like heights, so not climbing Big Ben.
I mean, the balloon people looked super comfortable with whatever was happening. Like, they didn't look like there was any stress on the balloon string. Like, they were just sort of floating independently of the balloon.
My palms are sweating just thinking about being that high above London.
I asked, because they like actually went out into a park and hoisted them. And I asked Ben Wishaw how high he was. He was like, oh, proper high. I was like, how high? I was like, above the tree line? He's like, in the trees. I was like, okay. Yeah, I could never do that. I'm terrified of heights. I could never, ever do that. But it's actually, it is interesting if you watch the balloon sequence, and, you know, for those of you who've seen it or are going to see it again or whatever, I did find myself watching, like, the third or fourth time I watched the balloon sequence, it's like trying to figure out where the harness is, like the harness is on them, obviously, but like they do really good arm acting in that. Cause like, I think they were just instructed, or there's a string that yoinks them, but like their arms are really hyper extended. You know, like sometimes when people are in a harness, like if you watch Julie Andrews in the original Mary Poppins, you know, she's harness flying through the air.
Michael Fassbender in, X-Men Apocalypse.
Possibly. But she's flying through the air, but her umbrella is just sort of like in her hand. And you don't really feel like that umbrella is carrying her at all. But like, with the balloons, you know, they shut their arms, like hyperextended them way up above their heads. And so like, yeah, the balloons are supposed to be the ones that are holding them, even though, yeah, there's no strain in those balloons. Anyway, and also if you watch that sequence again, they had the kid who plays Georgie, like dangling from a balloon, riding on top of a balloon. Like that Georgie is very irrepressible and just will.
He's a real scamp, that Georgie.
He's a little scoundrel. I love that kid.
But not that sequence, because I wouldn't be involved in that. Yeah. I would want to be in the Dalton Bowl because I want to know what I look like in one of those suits. Oh. One of those suits that's made for 2D animation photography.
The hand-painted suits?
Yes, I want one really bad. Mm. I like fancy clothing if it's ridiculous, and that just is like right up there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just do it just for the looks. I would have zero fun probably, but I'd be like, look at this. This is pretty sharp,
you
right?
Would
but
have
you'd be interacting
worst?
With 2D
no.
animated
he'd
characters.
He'd have the worst time because he'd be like, you're not lighted properly, Penguin. Don't talk to
Excuse
me. Until
me.
You're
Who
lighted
runs the
properly?
Lighting here? This is a theater, right?
Excuse me. Who's up in
this
there?
Is the
five
moment.
Zone? It's front stage center is
it's
really lacking in pink fill lights.
You are gonna have dinos on your dino tour, right? All right.
Yes, a hand painted leather jacket look. I'd take it. I'd be the Dalton boy Malcolm. Dalton Bowl Malcolm. Dalton boy Malcolm.
Dalton
now Bowen, though sounds
yep,
really good.
Yep.
All right, there we go. That's what it is. Hashtag Dalton boy Malcolm. All right, last prompt in Poppin' Type. Do we think there's going to be a Mary Poppins 3? Is that something we want? Do we want a collection of new vignettes?
That depends. Well, I will say this. They are rapidly running out of book material because, like, a lot of the other book material, a lot of the other things that what Mary Poppins does, she goes into worlds where there are, like, characters from other things that I don't know you could use, like Cinderella and stuff like that. Like you're getting into like Wreck-It Ralph Breaks the Internet sort of territory here. You know, I was trying to read through the books and see like what vignettes they left out that they could mine for a sequel, and I'm like they're running really thin.
Well, aren't there like more characters that like cameo in the first one but aren't actually like fleshed out?
Oh, like Andrew
the
and his
person with
mistress.
The talking dog
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I would watch an Andrew spinoff. Andrew's a really cool dog. We had one of our listeners ask, like, you know, so they did a time, you know, there's like 20 years forward in time for this. Like, do we want to see Mary Poppins like in the 80s or whatever? Like, don't. I think it worked the way that they use time in this, not just the timey-wimey heist, but also the jump forward in time, this idea of like, I mean, Jane Banks is doing okay. Like, I guess all she needed was a man, and Mary Poppins set her up, so that's fine. It breaks class boundaries, but that's fine too. We're progressive and cool, and that's great. But like, the fact that both the original film and this film are like kind of about helping save Michael Banks is, really impactful emotionally to me. And like, I don't think you can do that a third time. That being said, if this makes enough money, I definitely think Disney's going to try. So, you know, we'll see. What do you think?
Interesting.
Well, listen, as long as that Georgie kid comes back, I think we're in good shape.
Georgie all grown up. Georgie's
the new Michael.
Yeah. With an even bigger mustache.
With different problems.
Yeah.
He's got stock markets. He was Wolf of Wall Streeted.
No. His son's chasing a paper boat down a sewer drain when a clown bites his
arm. Stop.
And Mary Poppins is like, I'm coming in on the wind.
But also, you have to imagine that somebody has talked about it in Disney, right? Like, they've talked about, like, well, what if we did Cinderella? Like, what if we just made Mary Poppins Wreck-It Ralph? People like Wreck-It Ralph. So
I would assume that
I wouldn't
that
be surprised
conversation,
if something like that happened.
Right, if that conversation is side-by-side with straight-up remake conversation.
But also, like, you know, as much as there might be, I have to remember that these movies haven't come out yet, but as much as there might be criticism of this movie being a Force Awakens-esque remake of the first movie, imagine if they did it all again. And they're like, this time they ride peppermint sticks through the air. Like, because that happens in the books, and people are going to be like, I just saw this.
Yeah, they're going to have to do some weird stuff if they want to do another
weird
one.
Stuff. Yeah.
So that's, but I'm fine with that.
I'm not against a Mary Poppins 3, but I'm also okay waiting
Let's make a movie of the Quiet Place sequel where Mary Poppins shows up to help Emily Blunt, who is in her character in a Quiet Place, so then she plays two characters.
No, I like my It crossover better, because then you got Pennywise versus Mary Poppins.
I don't like you reminding me that a Georgie didn't make it. That poor Georgie.
Tough break for Georgie.
Well, in both movies, they all float, so it seems like that crossover is just like
wedding. Yeah. Or we could have this could be Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And like, you know, because of Yondu's whole Mary Poppins thing. No, nobody wants to come with me on this journey. Yeah.
Okay. Emily Blunt joins the Avengers.
Yeah, Emily Blunt could be a character.
Finally, Emily Blunt finally joins the Avengers. After being Black Widow because she had to do Gulliver's Travels with Jack Black. Oof. That's some old behind-the-scenes stuff I forgot about completely until just now. All right, I think...
You remember that John Krasinski was supposed to be... was in, like, late auditions to be Captain America, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh my God, they're the ultimate power couple of not getting roles in Marvel movies.
Yeah.
Because let me tell you, they are just fucking adorable.
They're doing fine. Yeah. They're doing just fine.
Doing just good in a Quiet Place and other places. All right. We are going to take a short break and then come back with some Poppins Gripes.
All right, this is the time of week where we thank our new and returning Small Council members. So I'm going to start with some newbies. We've got three new names to read out this week. SS Edwards, Nick Willard, and Christian Turner. You're new to the class. Welcome. And I also want to thank Catherine Truchon, Judy Wick, Cameron Fowler, Bronwyn Beck, Jen Calhoun, Jules TX, Delaine Mitchell, Amy Calhoun, Gretchen Linden-Smith, Christina Sullivan, Saquon Gatling, Liz Bislin, Matt Campbell, Riley Trahan, Joe Janka, Bryce Quinn. Thank you guys so much.
All right, my turn. I'm going to be very, very focused this time. I would like to thank Katie Salambier, Tom Whitham, Ira Storm, David Adams, Annie AK, Sean, Cosme, Megan, McLeod, David, Koplos, Yves, Fantila, Ryan, Silverstein, Lily, Lim, Melissa, Slaughter, Great on Toast, Steph, with an F, Chuck, Parky, Lauren, Wagstaff, Aaron, Go Work, damn it, DJ Empirical, Jim, Scott, and Stacy Winkleplek.
And if Dave mangled any of your names.
Dave mangled your names.
Let me remind you guys that you could send pronunciations to Joanna on the Slack.
New rules. Send them to Diana at Diana on our Slack.
Oh,
you can
perfect.
You can update your pronunciation at Diana on our Slack. All right, Neil, well.
Yeah, so I'm gonna try and do hopefully slightly better than Dave here. Thank Jocelyn, Luan DeMello, Cody Drygeese, Fiona Grimm, Aaron, Felix Jazz, Jabberly, Brian Rapp, Holly Hunt, Gustavo Villarreal, Sam Adolfo, Christine Kippens, Manu Mishra, Madison Ray, and Aubrey Iyer. I'm so happy that I picked the one that ends with, like, all our friends.
Yeah, crazy.
All of you are our friends.
Well, you're all friends, but, yeah. Like, people that, like, we, you know.
We know from Con of Thrones. A lot of people we didn't know before Con of Thrones last year come to Con of
Thrones
this year. And you could be, you know.
You could find yourself on the ground floor of some real special friendships.
Yeah, you could be like, why is Dave still saying my name wrong? I talked to him for 4 hours about taxes in Louisiana.
Yeah, like I would bet that some people whose names you just mangled, we have probably met.
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely Lauren. Anyway, thanks guys.
You're fantastic and make the show possible. All right, we're back. It's time for some Poppins gripes. So there's a 2D animation sequence, quote unquote, in this movie.
Which I liked. By the way, which I found charming.
Yes.
In my everyman sensibilities.
Oh, yeah. And as an every woman over here, I will say when the penguins were back, I was like, ooh, the penguins. And I loved that Irish setter. And I just enjoyed the whole 2D thing. But I'm curious what Dalton Boy Malcolm has to say.
Yes. Hashtag Dalton Boy Malcolm time.
You just have to think whether you should.
They made some weird decisions here in terms of what was going to be like 2D and what was going to be 3D. And what they ended up with was the backgrounds are like flats, like stage flats, placed in like a 3D different distance, which is different than the first Mary Poppins, which just used flat backgrounds. And then the carriage and the wolf's train or whatever that he's on with the stuff in the back of it are then like 3D objects that have had 2D skins put on them, and then they're sort of detailed in like a janky version of Into the Spider-Verse's like line texturing. And it just seems like a really weird decision to mix media in that way.
You know what it reminds me of? Speaking of what? Spider-Man, is in the Spider-Man video game when you can get the like the comic version. Where it's like a suit that's supposed to look like
the
comics.
Even that's cell shaded, which these aren't. Like, if you look at the penguins who are dancing with Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is on a stage, who is being lit by pink lights, the penguins aren't casting any pink lights, and they're black and white characters. So if you put them in any kind of light, they're going to start reflecting that color light back at you. And then Lin-Manuel Miranda's suit is all like supposed to be hand painted in pink, and it's naturally reflecting the light because they did a good job of lighting their green screen stage and actually had the kind of light that they were going to render in later. So the idea is, why commit to 2D animation mixed with live action, but then lock it into the Mary Poppins age when it's advanced to like even Who Framed Roger Rabbit did cell shading on its 2D drawings to make it look like those two things were existing in the same world. So now when they walk into the Dalton Bowl like auditorium and they're walking by people,
I think you mean Music Hall. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the Music Hall.
You gotta put a little pepper on it. Just put a little pepper.
The Dalton Bowl Music Hall. All the characters who are in the audience are like 2D, like stand-ups, and you could see as they're like moving through it, they're not rendered in any sort of 2.5D or 3D space, which is just like a weird, why render your environments that way and then populate it with cardboard stand-ups? Like, such a dedication to what the art is that you're just, like, chosen a weird design style. It really, like, tweaked my eye to a way where I was just, like, enjoying all the 3D effects that were going on, but all the 2D effects I was not into.
Well, forgive me if you already mentioned this in a way that I didn't quite catch, but how does it compare to the original chalk drawing sequence and the way that those, that 2D animation interacts with, like Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke?
So that's much more, I think, purposeful, and it's so because it's all in the chalk drawing and because there's no change in the lighting, it's not like they're in a theater that has, you know, like dim lights or colored lights or, you know, anything like that.
It's just
they're
like
all
sunshine, so it's outdoors.
Right. So it's going to keep the lighting even on all your characters, regardless of the environment they're in. And then the 2D characters, for the most part, are dancing on a green screen or whatnot, but they're not then placed in a fake 3D environment. They're placed on top of a 2D environment. So you're watching Dick Van Dyke dance across a painting or a chalk drawing. You're not watching them walk through.
Oh, on a set with stand-ups. Like giant fake, yeah, fake books on it and stuff like that. Okay.
Exactly. Well, and like the fake books I really like, and I really like the idea that the floor is part of the bowl and everything that they have to do with the crack I really like, but those are all 3D elements that are just hyper stylized to be in a certain way. All the 2D, actual 2D character elements, like it's admirable that they decided to go back to that style and I guess execute it in a 2D way, but to then composite them into the world as if they were just these 2D things that existed on two dimensions in a three-dimensional world seemed like a weird clash of design choices. In the first one, the humans enter a 2D world and the world's 2D. In this one, they enter a bowl and as 2D characters in a 3D world that's populated with like 2D chairs and 2D trees. It read as off to me. Or it didn't look as great as I wanted.
I mean, it's bothered you since the trailers. You've been talking about this since the trailers, so I know that to be true. I think it's possible that they intentionally tried to match, because I don't think the animators at Disney are like so dim that they wouldn't know that like the spotlight on a penguin should look different than a spotlight on a penguin in the shadow or whatever.
It's just a weird choice. It's a weird choice.
Well, I think it's an intentional. I would guess it's an intentional choice to try to match the look of the original as much as possible. Ditto the like beautiful briny scene in Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Like these are, but once again, those both that and the Mary Poppins things are humans in a 2D animated world, whereas this is some blend. And I my tiny brain can grok the basics and like the differences of what you're saying, but I will say that like looking at, even hearing what you have to say, looking at it does not offend my eyeballs. And I'm sorry that it's like it's a case of like you knowing too much to be able to just relax and enjoy something. And then that's definitely me in a lot of other circumstances. So,
well, I don't want to necessarily say that. What I do want to caution people against is saying that this is like really good, like enjoying it in the movie.
Right. Like I said, it's charming.
Yeah, no, it does exactly what it's supposed to do in the movie. And that's, you know, fantastic. But like it's, I don't want people to be like, thank God someone's saving 2D animation. Because if you're going to do it this way, it's just like, you know, making a weird choice in 3D animation.
Yeah, Disney's not saving 2D animation. We've all seen the Lion King trailer.
I think it works in the film as like this fantasy, and they made a lot of weird choices that I wouldn't have made. And you're right that it is intentional. Like they're not idiots. I was hoping in the trailer that like some of the shots just weren't fully rendered or whatever, but here we are. I've seen the movie. I wouldn't have made those decisions as somebody who is a fan of the original animation and animation techniques they're using here, but I think it works in the movie. Just don't be like, you know, Mary Poppins Returns has that 2D animation sequence. It doesn't. It has a 3D animation sequence with 2D characters.
Was this whole Poppins gripe a subtweet of what I said earlier?
No, I just knew that he was going to say this, and like, so when you were like, well, it's great, I was like, don't, you're poking the bear. The bear's already gonna rage later anyway.
I just it's especially coming off of Spider-Verse to see like what really integrating like 2D and 3D is. This one just, you know, wasn't that. Maybe that's it. Maybe I got spoiled by seeing that boundary actually broken, because that's what Mary Poppins like 2D sequence was initially. That was a cinematic boundary, you know, being broken by Disney and like the longest at that time live action animated integrated sequence in a motion picture. This one I don't think does anything that is necessarily groundbreaking, and maybe that's what I was looking for. If you're going to have an actual recreation of
you were looking for them to not replicate it, but to honor it by moving forward with it.
Yeah, try something, which is usually what I want in like remakes or legacy sequels.
Something, but yeah. If you've ever watched the Mary Poppins documentaries, there's a couple on YouTube, which I have watched all of them. You're welcome to my life. But the animator who did the penguins in the original, he has got this great sequence in one of the documentaries where he's like complaining about the dance sequence that Dick Van Dyke does there. Because like Dick Van Dyke did all his moves first, or I don't know the order of it, but basically Dick Van Dyke did his dancing moves, not saving room for all the penguins. And so the guy who animated the penguins had to animate the penguins like ducking and weaving and bobbing around Dick Van Dyke's legs, which is really fun to watch once you, and they're like, it's so cute. And it like look, and it actually, I think, makes it even better that they're like, hey, buddy, your leg. Ah. But if you watch it again, that's the animator being like, motherfucker didn't leave room for my penguins. But he found a good workaround. So there you go.
So this kind of brings me to my next gripe, which is like the Rob Marshall scope of Returns versus, I think, like the slightly more performance-based scope of the original kind of got to me by the end of Returns. I think it was the Lamplighters BMX dance sequence that I was like, all right, that's enough, you know, set piece for a set piece sake. Like, I don't know if we needed to go all the way to BMX bikers. Although I did really appreciate it with stuff like the bank set, when we were able to like return to it when it was empty and sort of having a bigger sense of space with it. So maybe I didn't dislike it as much as I thought, but I did think there was something, I don't know, the difference like a spoonful of sugar and the bathtub song, right? So like one is like this huge like introduction to a gigantic magic world. It's like get in the bathtub and we're in a whole different environment. Where a spoonful of sugar is like things going in reverse while we clean up your room. It just seems like this has a slightly more modern musical take on it. And I kind of wanted it to be closer in on the characters.
Listen,
no? Just me?
Here's all I have to say to that. Rob Marshall gonna Rob Marshall. They knew what they were getting. We all knew what they were getting when they hired Rob Marshall.
Well, okay, a couple things. It was Rob Marshall's idea to do this. So it's not like they wanted to do a Mary Poppins movie and they hired Rob Marshall. Rob Marshall comes to Disney's like, what if we did
Rob Marshall wanted to Rob Marshall a Mary Poppins movie.
And I gotta say that I was like so worried about this because I hated Into the Woods, which is like one of my favorite stage musicals of all times, and I think they did, Disney and Rob Marshall together did a just massacred that musical in a bad way. I don't know if there's a good way to do it. I don't know if the kids these days are going, oh, bloody massacred it. Anyway, point being, it was terrible. I like Chicago, but like Rob Marshall is real hit and miss. I don't often like his aesthetic at all. And so I was really worried about this, especially like because we've got the Paddington films, which are like sort of Mary Poppins-y in the story.
What, with a cute ass bear?
Well, in the storybook London,
in the tone,
in the storybook London thing that they tell, and this, and the aesthetic of that, the Paul King aesthetic of the Paddington movies, I think is so beautiful and perfect, and it's just like stylized but not like, you know, computerized in a way that, you know, I really hate. But between Chicago, Memoirs of a Geisha, Nine, and Into the Woods, which are Rob Marshall's, like some of Rob Marshall's previous hits, or movies, or Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, I really only like Chicago. And so I was really worried. I thought I was going to hate Mary Poppins Returns. I thought it was a bad idea too, like the way that I think Solo was a bad idea from the start. Like, do we need a Mary Poppins? Do you need a sequel or like a sequel to a perfect film? I don't think you do. And then I really, really, really liked it. And so maybe I just set the expectation, my bar like super low, and like Rob Marshall cleared it by not hiring Johnny Depp to like play the Lamplighter or something like that. I don't know. But, you know, I think aesthetically it didn't look as like shitty and computerized as like some of Rob Marshall's stuff can look.
It's very charming.
Oh, I guess that's true.
with all of its animated.
Like what was stuff like the Meryl Streep topsy turvy sequence. Like I like the look of that, that whole thing. Her character design, the design of her workshop, the way that they clearly just like rotated a room. It didn't look like shitty and plastic to me. And but I hear what you're saying in terms of like we could have used some quieter character moments. And I think that's why they have stuff like the Ben Whishaw like monologue at the beginning, because his little song at the beginning, which was added late in the production because they felt like we didn't really have like access to Michael Banks. And so they put that part in at the beginning of him like being like, this is the sorrow that I'm feeling. And that those are the kind of character moments. But at the same time, like I don't feel like we get Emily Mortimer so great, but we barely get any Jane. And I don't much know what's going on with Jane, except that she's got a political cause, like her mother had a political cause. And so, I think that there is room for more of it, and fewer, bathtub dolphins. I agree with you. But at the same time, I think that there is more of it there than maybe you're giving it credit for.
Maybe. I mean, even with like the Meryl. Yes, we could agree to disagree. We're going to move on to Julie Andrews versus Emily Blunt, which I think Joanna really pinpointed when I wanted to talk about at the top. We're saying that Emily Blunt's playing more of the book Mary Poppins, because there were times where I was like, soften up, Mary Poppins. There's a few times in this movie where Emily Blunt really looks joyous. I think she has a moment right before she goes into the bathtub that's actually a moment of Mary Poppins enjoying her work. But that's what I kept wanting to be like to Emily Blunt. Be like, look like you're enjoying this a little bit more. You know everything's going to work out fine. I don't think we needed as many Mary Poppins reaction shots in scenes Mary Poppins wasn't in. But other than that, really... I do like a slightly sterner Mary Poppins if I'm going to have to choose between the two Mary Poppins. So I think Emily Blunt is going to come out slightly on top as just a Mary Poppins that by default has more substance. Is that weird? Joanna, you seem to be disagreeing with me.
I'm not. Neil, what do you think?
Ooh.
I like them both. They're both pretty solid. I don't know. I kind of like the more stern version. Maybe I should read the books. That's really what I'm taking away from this. So I guess, I'm a, modern progressive person. I'm for Emily Blunt.
All right. Emily Blunt coming out ahead.
If I have to pick, I don't know. They both exist. It's fine.
I think maybe my favorite line reading from Emily Blunt is when Jack calls Mary Poppins up on stage at the music hall, and he's like, sing. And they're like, sing for us, Mary Poppins, sing for us. And she's like, oh, no, I couldn't possibly D flat major. So good. And I love, Julie Andrews' Mary was a little bit like this too. She's a little vain. She's a little self-absorbed. That's who Mary Poppins is. It's like kind of part of it. So, like when Julie Andrews goes cheeky to her own
mirror reflection.
It's a part of Mary Poppins. And like there, I was just rereading this whole sequence of the books where Mary goes out on her day with Bert in the original book. And she's like, it's like she shined up her parrot headed umbrella and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, Mary Poppins always like wanted to look her best and she believes she did. And like stuff like, it's just sort of like Mary Poppins thinks very well of herself. It's like a part of her. And, I don't know. It's kind of interesting because like she has this like, with time and distance, you just think of Mary Poppins as this like benevolent figure. But if you watch closely, like even the Julie Andrews, there's just like some stuff there where she's just like, it's to me. I don't know.
And here's the other thing I love about Emily Blunt. She overcomes a lot of this movie trying to get in her way to become such a charming and great Mary Poppins. Like, I feel like the rest of the movie is sort of working against her as like the star of this movie. But she still comes out being the best thing in the movie.
Yeah, which is, I think, not to knock Lin-Manuel Miranda yet, Neil. But
we'll get there.
There really is a sort of a feeling in Mary Poppins Returns that Emily Blunt is performing through this movie, like Neil was saying, against some odds. Because I don't think Lin-Manuel Miranda ever rises to the supporting player that Dick Van Dyke managed to be. He tries real hard, but we'll get there. But first, I want to ask about another actor in this movie that should have gotten more to do. Why does this movie waste Colin Firth? I ask you both. Shouldn't have we had at least one awkward song and dance number? Where's my investing your tuppence number, guys?
In the, what is it? Something fiduciary. He does have
the long name, Nick.
He does have that great moment where Angela Lansbury gives him a balloon and it just sort of thumps on the ground. Yes. That's my favorite Colin Firth moment.
I'm just happy for Colin Firth because he got paid for this and does not look like he did very much.
I like the thing I like about Colin Firth being in this movie. Is that this movie then has two Paddingtons, the original Paddington, Colin Firth, and the man who replaced him, Ben Whishaw. So if you just want to think of it as a tale of two Paddingtons, you can, if you want to. No? Okay. Colin Firth is originally cast as Paddington, is my point. Yeah, Colin Firth is just, like, there and not doing much. You know, he doesn't get a fun, like... Yeah, but Colin Firth barely did anything in Mamma Mia 2 except, you know, hang off the prow of a ship, which was enough.
He was having fun, though.
He did look like he was having fun. I don't know. This has been a weird year for Colin Firth. What else has he done? I mean, I guess Mamma Mia 2 and Mary Poppins Returns is plenty, but well, yeah, maybe it's time
it's
for
enough
him
to keep the lights on, I'm sure.
Maybe it's time for him to make a single man too, still single or something.
You're going to make three more Kingsman movies first.
Oh, yeah. See, I mean, that's the thing is, like, he has... Oh, he's doing a Secret Garden? Ooh. I love the Secret Garden. Oh, my God.
Colin Firth is always going to be there for you.
Wait.
Who else is in Secret Garden?
Don't look it up. I just need you to guess who plays the housekeeper in the Secret Garden.
No idea.
Think about what we're talking about and maybe another movie from this
Julie year. Andrews.
No.
What? Who plays the housekeeper?
I don't remember the story of A Secret Garden, so I don't know. But I have no context.
But you're very close with Julie Andrews as your guest.
Oh, really? Is it Angela Lansbury?
No. It's Julie Walters who plays Ellen, the cook in Mary Poppins Returns, and also the housekeeper in the Paddington films. So Julie Walters is just doing housekeeping now. That's all. Mm. That's it.
Julie Walters is going to show up as like a King's Landing maid in the background.
Just doing my part.
Game of Thrones.
I thought that was going to end differently, and I thought you were going to say Julie Walters is just going to show up as a Kingsman maid, and I'm like, now I want Julie Walters to like run the Kingsman house.
Be the secret Kingsman household person.
Yeah. the
Well, their house keeps getting blown up, so I'm sure she could get hired.
Oh, she would make such a great... anyway, justice for Julie Walters.
Always cleaning up blown up houses.
Who was great in Mamma Mia 2, which brings us back to Colin Firth. Okay, so anyway, maybe Julie Walters just wants to be in Colin Firth movies.
All right, this prompt I think is Joanna's. Can each host say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
Oh, you nailed it, Dave. That was actually one of our listeners that asked us to do that.
Nice. Yes, but only in a sing-songy way.
Ready?
Right? Because it's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, right?
Yeah.
No, it's more like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
See, I feel like you said it wrong there.
I did.
We're going to have to check.
if we want to...
So 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
If we want to like crown a loser for this, it was me. So twist. I did not expect that. Okay. To our last Poppins gripe.
Our last Poppins gripe comes from Neil.
Yeah.
The Lin-Manuel Miranda conundrum.
It's really the BMX riding elephant in the room.
I will say this.
Yeah, go ahead.
At the point, I was so on board with Mary Poppins Returns that at the point when Mary Poppins is doing like, I don't know, would we call that a wheelie, whatever it is in Triple Light Fantastic? I was like, she's doing it. It looks stupid. I don't care. Like,
and I had the exact same thoughts.
I was so in. I was just like, Emily Blunt has been asked to do this. She is doing it with aplomb. And I don't care. I think it's great.
Yeah. All right. So we got to talk about the Lin-Manuel Miranda conundrum here, because I really like Lin-Manuel Miranda. I like Hamilton, as we've discussed. I love the sort of rhythm and specificity of the way he delivers bars and lyrics. There's just a lot, like way too much of him in this movie. Because I think what happened is Rob Marshall, when he convinced Disney to do this, they got Lin-Manuel on board, and you can't waste that. Like, you have, that's in Rob Marshall's mind, this is what happened. We have this guy and he's great. He's super talented. He can sing. He can dance. He's a real Broadway star, and we're not going to waste it. And what ends up happening is it looks like every time a song breaks out, no matter who starts singing, Jack shows up and has to join in too. So this movie is like Mary Poppins Returns, but also Jack is here. And
have you met Jack?
Have you met Jack?
And Jack's like Bert, but Jack isn't Bert.
Have you met Jack?
So about halfway through this movie, I'm like, he really had, like, he's in every song. Like, he's just the chimney guy or the streetlight guy. Like, what? So there's just, there's an imbalance. And I think this is one of the things I was talking about earlier when I said that there are things working against Emily Blunt in this movie that she overcomes. A really weird sequence with Meryl Streep, I guess.
I like the Meryl Streep thing.
I mean, I like it. It's just, it's a little long for my taste.
It's not. It's like a song and like.
Yeah, I know.
10 lines of dialogue around it and that's it.
But the Lin-Manuel Miranda thing is interesting because I think there was an obvious decision made in the creative process that they weren't going to put Lin in the corner ever. And I think that it creates this weird dynamic where, and I get it at like at the end, it's all about, you know, the sister, right? Emily Mortimer's character finding the man that she needed. Total throwaway plot. You could have totally lost that and we would have been fine. Because both of them seem to be very busy. So I don't know how that relationship's going to work anyway. I really like the conundrum is I like Lin-Manuel Miranda. I enjoy everything he does. This just didn't use him well. They weren't efficient with their Lin-Manuel Miranda deliveries.
So I agree and disagree. I agree that I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is the weakest part of this by far. And it's not his shitty Cockney accent because Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, there's that too.
Dick Van Dyke had a shitty Cockney accent. And,
oh, wait, hold on. Before I forget, since you mentioned the accent, my favorite part of the movie is when they're doing a song about explaining a dialect, and it's the only American actor in the cast who's doing the explaining.
Well, then they drafted.
So
like,
great.
I think they drafted like a real Cockney kid to come in and like do something.
Yeah. Well, and it's also clear that like the other like leery dude that he's working with is a real British person.
Yeah, that's what I meant. My favorite line around accents is when Lin-Manuel Miranda says to Meryl Streep, "That's a strange accent you got there. Where are you from?" And she's like, "I think Emily Blunt goes, nobody knows." I thought they were winking at that. And I think his bad accent is sort of like that. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me, what I will say about Lin-Manuel Miranda is that I like him enormously as a human. I think that he is a genius. I saw him on stage in Hamilton. I don't think he is and you don't even need to see him on stage in Hamilton. You could just listen to the soundtrack. That man is not a very good singer. And he is not a dancer, and he is not even a terribly good actor. And he works okay in roles that he's written for himself, like Hamilton or in The Heights. But I've seen him in other stuff, like he did a Merrily We Roll Along, a Sondheim musical at Lincoln Center, and he was very bad in that. He's just like, I just think he's more, he understands musical theater. He can write musical theater and inventive and fresh musical theater, better than almost anyone else living. I really loved the stuff he wrote for Moana as well. But I would rather hear the actual singers in Moana sing that than Lin-Manuel Miranda sing it. And like, I just don't think he's a great performer. As much as I like him as like a Twitter user and as a composer. And so this
Tim, is Tim, I did not expect to have the second hottest take about Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I just think that that's true. I think that there's like,
you might be right. I mean, you know what it is though? He's got like a lane where he works.
Well,
as
yeah.
far as being a performer, it's like McConaughey where it's like, he's kind of just got that one lane.
Yeah, like he has that that bravado, like the reason he works as Hamilton is that like that bravado and that chip on your shoulder sort of thing, which is true of his character in The Heights as well. I just think that he's like writing himself into like the reason he wanted to make Hamilton is he saw himself in the story of this founding father, and so he wrote himself into that character. And so like there's him in that. And so when he's doing like the rap singing, like he does that very well. His mouth moves very quickly. He could do that very, very well. But as just like a pure singer, as like, I'm going to sing this like Under the London Sky and or Triple of Light Fantastic, like it's not great. I don't think so. You know, whereas Dick Van Dyke is great Dick Van Dyke is a song and dance man. He couldn't write Hamilton. But you know, Dick Van Dyke is a song and dance man. So you know,
well, I think that's the real hole for me is that like if you give Dick Van Dyke a character in a scene, he will make sure that you watch that character in that scene, even if it's like the dumbest thing, because Dick Van Dyke's going to come up with something to do with it. In the case of the like I was bringing up before, the invest your tuppence scene, he's doing like all this stuff as like an old man. He's falling forwards and backwards. He's like huffing in between like lyrics of the song. Lin-Manuel Miranda is executing like a plan. And it, because of that, I don't think the performance ever pops off, even when he's doing, you know, his rap singing, which the lyrics and the performance of is really good, but that's also the time with the goddamn penguins, which means they didn't think he was glitzy enough. They didn't think he was glitzy enough to not throw sparkles at the screen, which Dick Van Dyke is fine. Dick Van Dyke, it's, you know, just put him in a spotlight. He, even at, like in his 90s, all he has to do is dance on a desk and he's like, absolutely it belongs in this movie.
Yeah. So I think if we're going to like, who pales and compare, like, Emily Blunt does not pale in comparison to Julie Andrews. She's just doing something different from what Julie Andrews did. Lin-Manuel Miranda suffers hugely by comparison to Dick Van Dyke. And that's
agreed.
Just true. Yeah.
And I think he might be the only character that it like really suffers in comparison between the two movies. Like everybody else, I think, is doing a pretty good job on making it interesting. Kids to, you know, suffragettes to everything else.
Honestly, Emily Mortimer has like so little to do, and she does it very well. So hats off to Emily Mortimer.
Yeah, I will say this. At the very end, when he goes into that final refrain, my first thought about it was, of course, why wouldn't he have the last word in this movie? He has.
Mm-hmm.
He's shown up every single time, and I'm over it.
Well, I mean... On the one hand, I agree with you. I was a bit over it. I liked the friend of the show, Kitty Rich, is of the opinion that the balloon sequence is entirely superfluous. I don't think that. I like the balloon sequence. I like Ben Whishaw's physicality with the balloon sequence. I like all of that. But I do think that, you know, the Lin-Manuel Miranda sort of like bookend is not necessary, but you know, that's the Dick Van Dyke role, you know, that's what Bert does. So interesting, because like Bert is a, like, I don't disagree with you, but at the same time, like, if they're force awakening this, then like, yeah, they are going to give him the bookend, you know what I mean? And I think, you know, to go back to your like, nobody puts Lin-Manuel Miranda in the corner, it also sort of feels to me like, you know, Rob Marshall casting Lin-Manuel Miranda is not like some gross fame grab or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, he's casting like the hottest like musical theater, bona fide musical theater person in his production. So that's not like a shitty celebrity thing to do. But at the same time, it reminds me of like Sophie Turner being cast in X-Men, where like Lin-Manuel Miranda has this huge social media following. He's got this like following that's going to follow him to a film and want to see Lin in a film. And so that's another reason why I think you don't put Lin-Manuel Miranda in the corner, is because his fans, who don't realize that he's not a good singer, want to see him.
Yeah, you know who's not rioting this weekend is Colin Firth fans. So they definitely serve the right fan base there. All right, I think we all enjoyed Mary Poppins Returns. It definitely was a nice dose of whimsy.
It's delightful
at the end of a trying year. Neil. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Joanna.
Well, I just will say one last thing. I've had a couple parents ask me if they should take their kids to see Mary Poppins Returns. I was tempted to take my nephew to go see it because he loves the original Mary Poppins so much. There is a very scary, lengthy, like animated wolf chasing that I think would really flip.
It's not particularly well lit. So if you got a smart kid, they're just going to be pissed about that.
That's right. They're going to be like, where's my cast light in this?
Excuse me.
That's not how embers work.
But,
excuse me, Aunt Joanna.
Find
out that the kid's been listening to this podcast this whole time.
Oh my God.
Dave fan.
Haven't forfend his poor ears. But like, if, if your kid was freaked out by the wolf chase in Frozen, which I know did actually freak out a lot of kids, I would recommend waiting until this is on video and fast forwarding through this chase. It's a little scary, I think, for kids. So I'll just say that.
Yeah.
All right.
Fair enough. All right, Neil, what are we up to next week?
Well, next week we're having a great debate. We're going to debate it's a great debate about the best of 2018. We've already recorded it, so don't send us anything because we recorded it last week. So, I don't remember what I said. So I am looking forward to listening to it myself over Christmas holiday.
Rediscovering. So that next week, we're going to have a great debate about best television show and best movie of 2018. That's going to involve picks from us and you. And then we'll result in a poll like it does, and we'll decide the best things of 2018. It's going to be great. But until then, where can people find more of you guys on the internet? Let's start with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me and a lot of Poppins content over on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I'm almost done with all my podcasts for the year. Oh, if you're listening to this and you like Game of Thrones, which I think you might, you might want to check out the Nauticast podcast that's hosted by the two of the A Song of Ice and Fire moderators from Reddit, better known in the Game of Thrones community as Brendan Blackfish and Brendan B. Fish and Poor Quentin, Emmett and Jeff. And we talked for nearly 3 hours about Game of Thrones. So you can go hear that. That's, I think, up right now for their Patreon subscribers, but eventually will be out for everyone to listen to. It's called Not a Cast. So Notacast. Not a Cast. There you go.
Awesome. And Neil Miller.
Well, even though this obviously is the exclusive home of all my hottest takes, you can also get me on Twitter at Rejects. You can get some very good content over at filmschoolrejects.com, which, whether or not I wrote it, trust me, I at least checked it for plagiarism.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find my other podcast, Fighting in the War Room, at fightinginthewarroom.com, and play the Game of Daves for yourself. What am I? Dalton Boy Malcolm? Yes. Hashtag Dalton Boy Malcolm. And once again, do not fall down. We'll